What's up, ladies and gentlemen? After some technical difficulties, we here. I figured it out. I pressed a bunch of buttons. Anytime you are in denial or in some weird stage where you don't know how to fix them, just turn it off and turn it back on. It's called the reset. I'm John Browner. I'm joined here by my co-host Jason Lawhead on the mightier 1090 ESPN. What's up, Jason?
What up? That sounds fun to say, doesn't it?
Doesn't it, man?
Yeah,
doesn't
man. It it's right cool.
Sounds cool. Like where we belong.
Yeah, man. I got some texts from some friends just yesterday, just seeing me do some retweets and posts about, the venture. And they're like, dude, that's so cool, man. So I got some questions, though. I mean, I know you and the crew probably have talked about it more. I didn't get a chance to listen to yesterday's show, just knowing that the announcement was coming was exciting enough. And, got into that national championship game a little early. But will 1090 be like through an app of ESPN? Will people be able to find that? Do you know anything like that? Has you been privy to any of those little bits of like outer information?
So for people who are wondering, where do you find out more about Brown and Lawhead and Kaplan and crew now being a part of the ESPN mothership branch? We're part of a branch of a very large oak tree. You can head over to iTunes in the podcast store. Kaplan and crew download yesterday's show, or you can head over to YouTube. Kaplan and crew, like, subscribe, and share on both those things. As far as I know, we have access to live games being played. We have access to guests. They basically send out a list of people if you want them to be a guest on your show. But as far as what happens in terms of your question, I'm not 100% sure. I don't think we are available on the ESPN app as ESPN San Diego.
Right.
Because I know in the ESPN app, they have the ESPN Chicago, ESPN LA. I don't think
and those things take time to turn over anyway in the real world. Right. So eventually we'll probably make our way onto that landscape, probably, but it probably might not be, overnight.
One could hope.
Yeah.
We will find out. We'll find out. So, yesterday was such a busy day. We had something that happened in sports that, quite frankly, no one saw coming and almost never ever happens in sports. And so we were very preoccupied with the sporty nature of what the show is really based on, and as sports, of what happened between the Chargers and the Raiders and things from NFL, the final Sunday of the NFL season. And in doing that, we didn't forget. We just didn't want to not give it the proper amount of time that it was due. Bob Saget has passed. He was found unconscious in a hotel room. What I will tell you about Bob Saget is a sign of people liked him and he was respected by people within the industry and publicly. No one jumped to conclusions about what happened to him. He was found unresponsive in a hotel room and people are waiting for the information to come out. I didn't see one person go on television and say, oh, they bet it was this or they bet it was that. So that's always a great sign of how you lived your life and how you treated people, that upon your passing, people give you the respect that you've given throughout the times. And as we know, Jason is a famous comedian because he was next to Dave Chappelle's name and Louis C.K.'s thank you list. So Jason, talk to me about, educate the people about, because I have my piece, I'll say, but I'll give you first run about the passing of Bob Saget and anything you would like to say, or sometimes you met him or ran into him or anything of that nature.
So I met him a couple different occasions, was in the same kind of just space as him. I wasn't friends with Bob. I never got to know him on that level, although I know a lot of people that were, closer and some very closest to Bob. So knowing the Bob Saget behind the screen that most of us grew up on, I made a tweet yesterday going, hey, look, I didn't know Bob Saget, but we all kind of knew Bob Saget because he was a TV dad and a modern, there's Modern Family, is a big hit show now. Is like, that was the first Modern Family. Like, that really was like cool guys and uncles in charge of kids and, a father that had lost his wife and he was being a girl dad. And, but the real Bob Saget was a lot like what we kind of all knew, right? He popped on screen as vulnerable and accessible as Danny Tanner. And even when he went on to do funniest home videos, he came through the door to start the show and he just popped as accessible. He popped as vulnerable. And the coolest thing about, if you're ever around his orbit or got to be in a club at the same time or see him do a set, or, you know, we're in a circle to talk to him because I'm lucky enough to be around a guy like Bill Burr or something, and he's in that, you can feel that was him too. Like, he was all that, and he was famous, and none of it bothered him. He could publicly show some emotions. If you see a lot of the clips that people have shared, he wasn't afraid to cry on camera if he got emotional talking about the girls from the show when they had the reunion, or his tears coming out when Norm roasted him so eloquently on the roast. You know, his emotions, he wore those. And so that's what I love most about Bob Saget, is that guy was big time famous, and he acted like he was a guy you all knew, and he wasn't afraid to do all of that at the same time. So many, you know, famous people that people love are afraid to show really any emotion in the public forum or just hanging out. They keep up a little wall, they keep a barrier, they keep a couple of minions around them to stand in front of them to buffer conversations, right? And so so many people had so many, you know, famous people, regular guys, guys I know that got to open for him, guys that, you know, he loved to take on the road. He was so excited about where his year was going. And if you read like his posts and his podcasts and the guests, and he was just embarking on this great long tour starting through Florida. And yeah, it's sad. It just seems like something just bodily went wrong from what, you know, officials are saying. And it's unfair. He's only 65 and he worked so hard. He was working like he was still a hungry 30-some-year-old comedian. The guy was probably worth, I don't know, you know, 100 million, 50 million. I don't know. So that just says how much he loved life. And it's sad that we keep losing great comics that are better off here than us, you know, sharing our selfies or whatever. So rest in peace, Bob Saget. I feel terrible for his wife that he just married a few years ago after being single for 25 years. He finally, you know, met a love, and he has three daughters, and so many of the great friends that he had that, you know, are just spilling their guts over this. It's tough.
You know, it's hard when you see such a respected public figure in the entertainment industry go, because you feel like there's so many bad ones. And then you see it, and you see a guy like this pass, man, and it hurts a little more, because, you know, when I was growing up, again, I was a poor kid from the South Side of Chicago. Full House was about as white as a show as you could possibly get. And I watched it. And I watched it. So, you know, it there are two, maybe, it to me, there are three TV dads, maybe four. Obviously, the rapist Bill Cosby is one of them.
Yeah, I mean, he did like all that. Like, we loved him. We loved that guy when he was the TV dad then. It's like the OJ that sold Avis her rental cars. We loved that OJ.
right. Clearly, James Evans from Good Times.
Ah.
TV dad.
Great TV dad.
Bob Saget. TV dad. And, I mean, it depends on how you intake the television. Homer Simpson. Like,
yeah.
So,
for a lot of people,
those are like, I mean, one's not a real person. So, but these are also characters, so they're not real people. So, where do you draw the line? But anyway. It honestly feels like to me those are the four TV dads that, doesn't matter where you are from, you absorbed one of those people being a father on television, and that father stuck with you. And Bob Saget cracked that really, really difficult bubble. And to then leave such a successful show and then show up on America's Home Videos and still be able to touch the accord of people, to still get people's attention as someone outside of how you had gotten to know him. I mean, it just means that he was a special person.
Yeah.
And so for him to have unfortunately passed away at what we keep saying it's a young age, but a lot of people are dying going into 2022. And just saying, we keep saying that, well, that was young. That person was young, with the exception of Betty White. She had a good run. So it's unfortunate, but I hope people remember him for all his great work and the contributions that he made to comedy and to the industry. And because I think that's the way we should always remember people.
Yeah, and the charitable donations. I don't want
right.
to butcher the name of the disease that his sister died of at the age of 47, but he's been just steadfast on raising money and doing everything he can. It begins with an S, and I don't want to. I'm bad. I'm like my mother. I see a word and I see it, read it wrong and butcher it. But
man, I see a word. I see it backwards. It's called dyslexia.
Yeah, I don't have somehow. It that bad. I just have like just pronounce. I have something like I'm like not hooked on phonics is what I'm. I'm like far from.
You're not hooked on phonics. Yeah. You're sort of attached.
Right. Yeah. I'm phonics deficient. So, but. Yeah, man. So all of that stuff. And he played a sportscaster on that was his job on
right.
the show. Like, that's what he did for a living. So, you know, he was a guy that, you know, loved hockey. And I think Dave Coulier got him into hockey. And so anyway, rest in peace. Really tough loss. And just, you know, for comedy, just for, you know, people that loved being entertained and turning on the TV and seeing Danny Tanner, and man, sucks.
You know what sucked too? This for people in Alabama.
They need 10, play clock at 4. From the pocket, launching downfield, underthrown and intercepted.
I love it.
Kaylee Ringo has an escort down the sidelines.
Play the Ray Charles music now. Georgia on my mind. Oh, yeah.
I got to tell you, man, I didn't think Georgia would win that game. That stepson, Bennett, whatever the hell his name is, that quarterback, that kid was absolutely terrible. And they tried to sell you his life story as hard as they could when they realized they were going to win that game. Bryce Young was bad, but Bryce Young was bad because the Georgia defense won this game. The Georgia defense was absolutely phenomenal. I don't care that they had a couple 26-year-old kids on their team. That defense... They do. They do. I'm not making it up. That's a fact. They got a 6'6", 320-pound kid. He's a man. He got child support payments. I don't know if that's true. That was a joke. Don't.
Yeah.
But
don't cancel me off ESPN. Just
right. You know, I just got here. The idea that a defense could dominate a Nick Saban team when Nick Saban is known for having suffocating defenses. I got to take my hat off to Kirby Smart. I got to take my hat off to Georgia, because the one thing that they did, and they decided on it, and they didn't care what happened afterwards. They stuck to their plan. They faced a quarterback who had won a Heisman Trophy. They did not go, okay, well, this kid is dangerous. He's good. We're going to sit back and wait for him to make a mistake. They said, no. We've been blitzing all year. We've been blitzing our linebackers on third down all year. This ain't going to change it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? We're going to blitz on first down. And at some point, they just started getting to him. And it warmed down. And then he started seeing things that were not there, like that last interception that kind of pretty much sealed the game. That was a terrible throw to nowhere. And it just so happened that, you know, that Georgia had a kid there and they sealed the game. But I got to take my hat off to Georgia. I got to take my hat off to the people at Georgia and Kirby Smart and all the players, old and young, for getting that thing done, man.
Yeah, they were fast last night. Georgia was really fast.
Yes.
I thought that was the biggest difference, just from the eye test to just looking at plays develop. Even when Alabama got stuff and things were, you know, kind of just mushing back and forth with some field goals, I just thought Georgia was just faster on the field, faster at plays that they knew were the plays that were going to keep them in the kind of the driver's seat. And yeah, right. I think it just kind of evolved down to that. I was telling my one buddy, I was like, I think if football was played over 5 quarters, Georgia probably would have won that game by 4 or 5, maybe 6 touchdowns. You know, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yes.
If there was, it just happened to just be going that way. And you know, it was speed and the fact that they were able to run the ball successfully through drives.
Nice.
And Alabama couldn't get an inch with the running game. And it exposed Bryce a little bit you know, knowing that when there is no running game and your opponent's fast, you know, he's got some deficiencies in certain areas, at least of decision making on the, you know, Georgia just looked like such a better football team as the game went on.
I would say this about Bryce Young. He is a freshman. He's got a long way to go, but he looked like last night he's got a long way to go. The upside for Bryce Young in Alabama is they don't play a team that look like Georgia very often. And last time they played Georgia, they stumped a mud hole in them. So I what this game showed me was the parity in college football is there is no parity. There is SEC football.
Perhaps Kirby Smart also knew we lose this game, we're in. Like, we are the most afforded losing team in a conference. And yes, I do have guys out. And guess what? I'm not going to show you as much blitzes. I'm not going to commit to certain formations and runs. I don't care if we lose this game. Hey, if we win it, play in a way that I don't want to have them to be able to have film on when I see them in a month. Because you had to think,
right?
Hey, look, if we lose, we're still in. If they win, they're obviously in, and we're probably going to get split in the brackets. So if I see them again, it's going to be in the bowl game. So I had that in the back of my mind because I feel like he started, you know, it's like, you know, he just started really opening his wallet as the game went on and started really kind of spending on his players in a sense that going, go ahead, now go get it, like, here. Right. And, I think maybe he even – you know, hey, you're going up against Nick Saban. You got to have some strategies. You got to play chess, not checkers.
The problem with what I saw last night, and the problem is what we have seen, the last three champions are Georgia, Alabama, and LSU. If another SEC team wins next year, you will start to see college football become such a regional sport, similar to baseball, that I think it would hurt. I mean, obviously, it's not going to hurt recruiting. It's not going to hurt the brand from a local standpoint, but from a national standpoint, I think that game wasn't really something that you should run to your television and see, because we all say we like good defensive battles. That's about as good as you're going to get in a championship game. Mm-hmm. And the most of the things you saw on the internet, that the game was boring, which it wasn't. It was a great defensive played game. But when you are having such a unleveled playing field of skill and size and talent and speed, Georgia clobbered Michigan, clobbered them.
Mm-hmm.
Alabama clobbered Cincinnati. And you got the game that you should have gotten from the two teams that they clobbered. So unless we can find a way, or somebody can find a way, to get a team outside the SEC rolling, whether it be Michigan or Ohio State or Michigan State or USC, some Oregon, somebody's got to do something. Notre Dame, somebody has to do something to make college football more than just a team from the SEC winning the national championship. Because I got to tell you, man, that's going to start hurting the sport as a whole.
Well, and I've said this before, if you really want this not to be Georgia 1 year, Alabama 1 year, LSU 1 year, Clemson 1 year, and back to that rotation, perhaps a Big Ten, Ohio State gets really good enough every one of those 8 years and sneaks in with one, right? But if that's not what you want, you have to go to a 16-team playoff. And especially if your gripe is, well, look at all these other bowl games. These kids just sit out because they're not. Well, then create this thing, right? Shorten up the regular season. Expect bigger teams to play tougher schedules so you can really get a good ranking process. And then get yourself a 16-team playoff starting shortly the week after the conference tournament play into the New Year Bowl Game Championship, because the only way you're ever going to have any type of Cinderella situation where a team like a Cincinnati could beat an SEC team is in a round two, in a something like that, where you don't have a month. Right. You give Nick Saban a month to prepare for anybody out of conference that isn't Georgia. Basically, I don't care that guy. They're going down. There's no chance for an upset when you have that parameter. But when you get back into that mental, like a second regular season, you got to be ready to win every week. Sometimes you trip up. Maybe if you have to win four to win the national title, game two and three, you could get beat by a lesser opponent out of conference because they got confidence. You might be hurt. But that's the only way this system gets better, or we're just going to see this on rinse and repeat every year, and you're going to see kids sitting out other ball games that you can't believe. Well, why wouldn't you? Like, so that's the system.
I think there's a mandatory understanding across the board that the playoffs need to be expanded. The question is how big, and the question is when. But as far as that question goes, I don't think we're going to get the answer to that question for a very long time. But we have created more questions within the NBA. What's up with the Lakers? What's up with Ben Simmons? What's up with the Chicago Bulls? So many questions, and we'll try to answer some of those questions here on Brown and Lawhead, Mightier 1090 ESPN.
Okay.
Welcome back to Browner and Lawhead here on the Mightier 1090 ESPN. If you missed anything, you can head over to the iTunes podcast store, like, share, and subscribe, Kaplan and crew. And you can do the same thing on YouTube. We shared our memories of Bob Saget and his ability to be the television dad and to get into the Mount Rushmore of television dads. We also talked about what happened last night in the national championship game and kind of some of our feelings on that. And during the break, Jason and I were having a conversation that I didn't intend to swing over, but he was making some valid points. And so we're going to now have a quick conversation about San Diego State, maybe quick, maybe short. But I find San Diego State basketball's win over Colorado State to not be very impressive. Jason disagrees. Explain to the people, Jason, why you disagree.
Well, and I said during the break, I said, look, as far as on the face of it, Colorado State, sure, maybe their undefeated record going in is a little bit, you know, inflated in the minds of, you know, others just seeing it on paper for who they play, and they hadn't played a road game. But look, when you if you love basketball, if you love to watch really good basketball being played, that game was one of those. San Diego State just didn't be. I don't even care if Colorado State was 8-3 and averaging 77 a game instead of 11-0 averaging 82 a game. The fashion in which this Aztec basketball team, I was watching most of that going back and forth to the Chiefs game. I had that on picture in picture. And I was just, as a basketball purist, the son of a coach, a guy that loves the game and loves seeing just it played at such a just team high level, individual play, team play, sharing the basketball, talking on defense, just laying down unbelievable defense and rim protection and getting after second shots. It was a beauty to watch. And I can't wait to watch this team more and more as the season goes on. Big kudos to Coach Dutcher. And he's always a class act. He's always giving credit to the kids for how hard they worked in practice, getting ready, and his assistant coaches. But, man, he had that team like a well-oiled machine.
I've always enjoyed, back in Steve Fisher's days, the early days, San Diego State's brand of basketball. I appreciate defense. I appreciate communication. I appreciate rotation. I appreciate guys diving on the floor. I appreciate his ability and Dutcher's ability as well, piggybacking off of that, to get the JUCO guys who mm-hmm. fell a little short or weren't recruited to the level that they felt like they should have, to take a transfer that didn't where everybody takes transfers now, but to get a kid who didn't work out somewhere and for him to find his footing at San Diego State once he either comes back to reality about his status in the college basketball world or just gets a better coach that kind of works better with what he wants to do as opposed to where he was before. I love the way that they run their program. I wish they recruited more in San Diego, but that's a completely different conversation for another day. The win over Colorado State doesn't do much for me because Colorado State didn't have any pros on that team. There are no NBA players on Colorado State. So the undefeated record doesn't move me. It simply just shows me Colorado State played no one. And it was fortunate that they didn't play anyone until they got to San Diego State because that will look better when it comes tournament time if we're looking at an at-large bid. But what I want to see more from San Diego State, I want to see more of what we saw against Colorado State. What I think we're not mentioning is when you have an undefeated team come in your building, at that point where they were undefeated, you are laser focused.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean laser focused, because you want to be the first one to knock them off. There's something to that, and you get to carry that all year. I don't know if this particular team, I don't know if they can keep that. I really don't. I don't see this team being like the teams of the past, being laser focused, being like, I think it was 2 years ago where they were undefeated and then COVID beat them. So I love the program. I like the way that they run their practices. I like the way that they're playing style. Again, I wish they recruited better locally, but again, that's another story. But the Colorado State win didn't really move me the way it moved a couple of people who I'm in communication with when it comes to college basketball.
And I get it. That's you make some good points about not having the NBA guys and seeing a top, program, echelon program as far as the Mountain West is concerned, or kind of the outer liar conferences. San Diego State
has beaten big names.
Right. No, I'm saying, and they do get credit for being a marquee program outside of the big major conferences. They sit on one of those stoops of, different, Butlers and different kind of, programs that we know of that aren't in the big conferences. So yes, I get that. Colorado State coming to a real opponent, haven't played a road game and those things. But like I said earlier, I don't care if Colorado State was 8-3 and they're averaging 75 a game or whatever it was, the fashion in which this team, and look, I think Bradley's a leader from what I've watched a couple of times. Maybe this is the switch. Sometimes a team that knows they've got, the right things in place and are identifying leaders as the early part of the season goes on, and Bradley transferring over from Cal, really good individual player. I see a lot of Mitchell in him as far as being a guy that you can just give the pill to and go get you 6, 8, 10 points in a row in a stretch and be hard to guard and get things open for other guys. So I liked what I saw. I get your sentiments, but this could be the ignition switch to bigger and brighter things for this team as the season moves forward and seeing more of these kind of performances against the teams they have to do it in and night out.
I also have very high expectations for that team, and I don't know if that's fair.
Yeah, no, I do too, and they should.
They've been the best team in California for almost a decade. So regardless of what the national view of them is, it's not UCLA, it's not USC, it's not Cal, it's not Gonzaga. But they've been up there with Gonzaga as far as wins, as far as putting guys in the pros, and competing in a tournament year in and year out. So my expectations of them are extremely high, and I think that goes into some of what I'm saying about the Colorado State win as well. I expected them to beat them, so I wasn't moved when they did, because I'm like, that's the San Diego State that I've become accustomed to, and I think that's the San Diego State most people here have become accustomed to, and I think that's why they haven't gotten as much attention this year, because they had a couple early losses, which kind of leaves you scratching your head about what's going on and what's happening with the roster and the recruits and things of that nature. But what's
but
going on?
I'll tell you
on
what, though, 30 plus points under their average, they held them, and I think about 21 percentage points under their shooting percentage. That's impressive. But let's move on. Go Aztec.
Sunday was a phenomenal day, and Sunday was a phenomenal day, not just for football, but for basketball, because on Sunday it was also Clay Day.
See Stevens.
Here's my cat.
Trying to slow down Clay Thompson. That's a top baseline jumper. Clay just told Looney, I got marketing. Let me handle him. And fading jumpers, perfect. Clay for three. Here we go.
That man missed 2 years of basketball.
Yeah.
That was his first game back. Now he got, I think they say he had 20 shots in 18 minutes or something absurd like that. But I cannot recall a moment of pure joy from an overall standpoint for one individual player across the league. I think Klay Thompson's a good guy. His father obviously played in the NBA, so you know the name Thompson. Klay Thompson is probably one of the more cooler dudes that you will probably observe in the NBA outside of the actual court. And for the reaction for him coming back, and playing as well as he did against a good Cavs team, I gotta say, man, I was blown away by the return. I was blown away by the production in the return, and he looks to be on the right track to returning Golden State to one of those teams you do not want to play.
Oh, I mean, are you kidding me? Right? Yeah. I mean, the Cavs were they were up for that ball game, and that's a Cav team yes. that had been playing good defense as a unit, especially against some pretty good opponents. When you look at the metrics all year long, they've challenged shooters, they've challenged teams at the basket, they've been able to really play some steady on the ball defense. Obviously, that's my team, and you know, Clay was a big reason. Obviously, Steph had a great game coming out of the gate, but Clay was a big reason. His just being on the floor and in that rotation early gave the Cavs problems knowing where to be at defensively. Looney, we just let Looney kill us on the offensive glass because Clay's mere presence running off picks, mm-hmm. trying to get open on the wing while you got to deal with Curry handling the ball. So good luck, everybody. Good luck now, as hard as Golden State was to defend, and they're only going to become a better two-way team once he gets his sea legs under him and he starts feeling comfortable moving around the offense. He's going to only start feeling comfortable moving around the defense and picking up guys and getting back to the defender he was. So come All-Star break, when he's feeling, you know, 100% and he's got rotations down and he's feeling like, you know, he really is back in his body. Whew. And it's interesting, the West. This is the first time this Golden State team assembled has a West that looks like the old East, right? Remember, the West yes. used to be like, there'd be like between the fourth seed and the 11th seed, there maybe be a 2.5-3 game difference. Remember that?
Yeah.
Now there's a 5 game difference between the 4 and 5. And when you look over at the East, those records are more like that. I think there's a 4-game mm-hmm. difference between 4 and 11 in the East right now, where there is a big gap of games between 4 and 5. And then it gets really kind of pond watery there at about 7, 8, and 9, where it used to be so deep at 11 and 12 in the West. It looks like that. So keep Clay back, right? You got a Wiggins has found his way in that on that team and fitting in. Mm-hmm. Steph playing MVP basketball with a watered down West at the bottom. Oh boy, good luck.
I think what you're going to see post All-Star break is you're going to see Steph Curry playing at an extreme. He's been shooting poor lately, but no one expects for that to continue. You have Steph Curry playing at a high level. You have Klay Thompson back in rhythm. You have Andrew Wiggins now finding his position as the fourth best player on that team, because Draymond Green is going to be controlling that defense. Right. And you're going to get James Wiseman, a 20-year-old athletic monster, who, by the way, all they're going to tell him to do is block shots and offensive rebound.
Right.
And he's going to be a absolute monster. I think there was a lot of talk about the Golden State Warriors trading for pieces, and we'll talk about trades in a second. And they held firm and said, no, we're not trading for Ben Simmons because we don't need to. We got Draymond Green. They're kind of the same player. And to get him, we'd have to give up stuff that we're not comfortable giving up right now. If James Wiseman comes back and is worthy of the number 2 pick, which is basically the level that DeAndre Ayton plays at, If James Wiseman can play at the level of DeAndre Ayton, and you get those other guys basically doing what we're used to them doing, and then you got Jordan Poole coming off the bench, you got Toscano coming off the bench, you've got Moody coming off the bench, Andre Iguodala, Kevon Looney,
Looney's got, playing great.
You got Jonathan Kuminga. This is bad for the rest of the league. This is bad. And we love to talk about how Brooklyn's built. If they played in the finals, Kyrie can't play in either one of these games. So we're getting to a place now where the Lakers become a part of this conversation. Because as much as the Warriors seem to have turned it around, and they seem to be going in the right direction, the Lakers appear to just be rudderless. They can't beat a team over 500. Jason, what have you thought of the Lakers of what you've seen so far? I know there's a long way to go, but what have you thought about what you've seen so far?
Well, that longer way to go just keeps getting shorter in spurts, though. You know, there's at some point that longer way to go is gonna be time's up, right? I mean, I'll tell you what's a longer way. A longer way is the last time they beat an over 500, which was a month ago. They beat the Mavericks by a 3 buzzer by Reeves in overtime. Luka didn't even play. AD was starting. LeBron was starting. Russ was starting. I mean, they've only won 5, I think, against above 500s, and they were all front heavy. They stole that one from Memphis early, their first win, when Ja Morant made that bonehead play, and that was before Memphis really got rolling, right? Now Memphis has beaten them, I think, 3 straight since, and just mopped up the floor with them a few times. I mean, they made that little token comeback the other night, but that was a 20-point loss throughout the whole game. In LA, right? So they won 4 straight a second ago, but they were all against below 500s, severely below 500s. As we said, they're the best thing the Lakers have going for them right now is a watered down West with less teams to have to try to kind of pull yourself up from the mud through, because they just don't look like the type of team against good teams that play good defense, that, you know, have guys that can go for, you know, 34, 35 a night, be the leader, be the kind of guy that could, you know, LeBron's putting up these crazy numbers, and you look and you go, well, they're just against nobodies, or it was in a period where you had 5 straight losses. What good is that? So it gets shorter, all this. It's a long season talk. And I don't know. I mean, when you look at a team like Golden State, when you look at the team like the Suns, when you look at teams the way teams like Chicago, Memphis are playing on a nightly basis, Memphis. LA doesn't mirror that at all. They don't come anywhere near close to that.
If this continues, there's a lot of talk out there about Ben Simmons, and now they're talking about throwing Tobias Harris in with Ben Simmons. When you start adding on that amount of salary, there's only a couple of places that those two players can land and still be competitive, because no bottom feeder is going to trade their future for these two dudes. And a contender has heavy contracts. And so there's only a couple of places where, as a pair, you can trade these two teams. A lot of people are saying now it's Atlanta. There's already whispers about Los Angeles, Portland. Some people have said Minnesota. This is what I will tell you. The Lakers have to trade Russell Westbrook. I don't know what they're going to add in. They don't have any draft picks because they gave all those up for Anthony Davis. I don't see a clear path for the taker of Westbrook. Because if I'm the Philadelphia 76ers, I don't want Russell Westbrook.
Right. I mean,
to do what? To argue with Joel Embiid? I don't want that. And if I'm Russell Westbrook, I damn sure don't want to get traded to Orlando so the Lakers can get a bunch of pieces for me. I'm going to veto that immediately. So I don't know the next place that the Lakers go, but Ben Simmons and Tobias Harris aren't the answer, even if you are able to construct some wild, crazy trade that involves them.
I don't think just Ben Simmons is the answer to anybody for anything when you look at the fact that you just can't trust putting this guy in the final 6-7 minutes of a, you know, playoff game and be comfortable with it. It's hard because really all the good teams out there that really are like have a window to be somewhat of a, if not a favorite to win it all, at least have a puncher's chance and be in that mix, they've all got good point guards. They've all got good guys running the point. They all seem to play pretty good team defense as far as when you narrow down the best teams that you would think have the ability to do what they can do. So, I mean, the Sixers are – and like you said, even if the Lakers were to decide and could make a deal and say, hey, this is where we can fit Ben Simmons in and we even get to pick up Tobias Harris, we'll move Westbrook. Look at – I don't think Philly does it out of the sole fact that Philly fans already hate Westbrook, right? They already hate this guy. And it's hard enough for what they've had to try to entertain their fans on in this whole Simmons debacle and how to keep Joel Embiid happy. Westbrook comes to a team that's teetering with their fan base already, bringing a guy that they hate. And if things don't go right, oh, man, they'll burn that arena down, those people.
You've got to be careful who you hire. I don't understand how a guy like Daryl Morey can fail up.
Yeah.
If you watched the way the Houston Rockets ownership and front office absolutely melted down, they were a game away from beating the Golden State Warriors and going to the NBA Finals. A game, quite frankly, three quarters, if we're being honest. You turn that around. That's with Kevin Durant. You turn that around to what they look like today, and now Daryl Morey is on another roster, basically wasting a career year for Joel Embiid because he doesn't want to get him enough help to fix the Ben Simmons situation by trading Ben Simmons. So this is a situation where the Sixers look like after trust the process to still be a dumb organization. Like this goes to show, it doesn't matter how many draft picks you have. Looking at you, Danny Ainge. It doesn't matter how many draft picks you have. It's the person drafting that makes the difference. It's the person putting the team together with those picks that make the difference.
And that's where Morey right now has his lifeline, right? His lifeline is, I didn't draft this guy. I didn't give him all this money. You stuck me with him. So that's his float right now. I don't know how long he's got that float, how long he can use that float without at least trying to make a move or have something come out publicly where, hey, there's a deal here and play. This is an offer. How can't these guys take whatever? I'm working my butt off here. But as to just hold him hostage because he was doing that to you type of thing, it almost starts to become kind of this immature staring contest in a way. So it's going to be interesting.
And everyone loses a staring contest, but you'll win because tomorrow we're doing an all playoffs AFC, NFC breakdown. Brown and Lawhead, Mitre 1090 ESPN.